The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. Last time I was here, Sunday mornings. So, so this evening I want to talk a little bit about what for some people is considered a very important topic in Buddhism, and that is the topic of karma and the role that intention has in karma. And in introducing this topic, I'd like to read a story or tell a story from the Chinese Zen tradition. And the story is called Yakujo and the Fox. And it's just kind of a story about a fox. And the story goes that there was a Zen monastery and with lots of monks and a teacher, abbot. And when the abbot would give his Dharma talk, there would always be this old man who came visited the monastery, would come in and sit in the back of the hall to listen to the Dharma talk. And as soon as the talk was over, this old man would leave. But then one day, the Dharma talk was over, and all the monks left the room, but this old man stayed behind, and he came up to the abbot, and the abbot said, "Well, you know, what's keeping you here?" And so the old man said, "I'm actually not a man, I'm a fox." And I've been a fox for 500 lifetimes. And see, what happened to me was, I used to be the abbot of this monastery. And someone came to ask me a question. And they asked, "Does an enlightened person..." "Does an enlightened person fall under the law of karma or not? Does an enlightened person somehow, you know, succumb or not succumb, but somehow get caught up or is involved in the process of karma?" And when I was asked that question, I said no. And for this answer, I had to be reborn 500 times as a fox. So now I've come in front of you, and I'm asking you, does an enlightened person fall under the sway of karma? And the abbot said, "An enlightened person does not ignore karma." So he didn't ask the, it didn't answer the question the way it was asked, that they fall under the sway of karma, but rather said, you know, doesn't ignore karma. And so the old man said, "Thank you. And you can send the monks tomorrow out over the yonder hill behind the trees and by the boulder there." So the next day, the abbot did, and there they found the body of a fox that had died. And they brought the fox back, and they gave him the memorial service for a monk and buried him with like a monk. So you have to be very careful what kind of questions you answer. And I'm going to have to be very careful what I say about karma today, or if I get it wrong, the karmic repercussions might be that I have to come back here and sit in the back and listen to talks. So I don't know, maybe some of you are. Some of you come here a lot and sit in the back and still working it out about karma. So karma. So the difference between being caught in karma, caught up in karma, to the sway of karma, versus not ignoring it, being clear about it, seeing it clearly what it is a big difference. An enlightened person sees karma, knows karma, and that's how they're free, is because they know what it's about. And in the seeing, perhaps they can be free, even though they might still be under the, under the law of karma, like everyone else. So it's interesting, there's this famous Zen story. There's a little, after the story is told, the person who collected these stories in a collection of Zen stories, an ancient Zen teacher, wrote a little commentary. And for this one, he said that the abbot, the fox, was reborn for 500 lifetimes, but was reborn for 500 happy lifetimes. So why does he say that? And I don't know why he wrote that, but I think because the abbot was enlightened, but he wasn't enlightened enough, wasn't wise enough, didn't understand well enough. So he wasn't certain kind of way, wasn't caught up in the world of karma, but that wasn't the right answer. But in his freedom from it all, he could be a fox happily. So just to be happy in the practice is not enough if you want to not be reborn as a fox. Something like that. Anyway, so that was the introduction. Maybe you'll never forget this talk. Just because of the story. Because the topic of karma is sometimes considered kind of complicated. And I hope to make it clear enough what I think the most important aspect of it is. So the word karma literally means action. But sometimes in modern English, people use the karma a lot, and they use it usually not so much to mean action, but they mean it more like the repercussions of your actions. You did something in the past, and your karma is something happens in the present. That's your karma. That's the results that you have to live with. But that's not what the word means. Literally, it doesn't refer to the results. It refers to action. And that's a very important distinction, because at least in early Buddhist teachings, the emphasis was not on the results that you receive, but rather the action that you do. Your action, what you do, the choices you make, are what's most important. And the teachings of karma, as far as I can understand them, their main function is to point us back into the present moment, to be really careful to see the choices we have and make wise choices by how we live. And so to spend a lot of time wondering, what did I do in the past that I have to kind of live with this today? That must be my karma, and I must be responsible. Something happened in the past, something. Is an analysis the Buddha seems to have never made. That kind of preoccupation with finding the reason in the past. And some people can really burden themselves because they think that they're somehow responsible for what happens today because they did something terrible in the past. The most common place we see it is with people who get sick. And someone will say, well, that must be your karma. And they just, now they feel awful because it kind of implies, I must have done something really bad before. So I'm a bad person, or I did something, made a bad choice or something. But this idea that we're using the teaching of karma to look into the past, to blame ourselves or kind of be under the weight, was not the function of this teaching. The primary function, at least that I find valuable, is really pointing us to the present moment. And as we do so, that's part of the function of mindfulness, to do that, to really bring us into the present moment. Because the more you can be attentive and clearly present for what's happening here, clearly attentive and heightened mindfulness, the more choice you will see. If you don't see that you have choice, you have no choice. And if you don't see that you have choice, then you're much more under the sway of conditions and circumstances, and sometimes we don't understand why we're saying what we do, why we do what we do, what happens to us, because we don't see the causality, we don't see the conditions that are operating, and we don't see what we're contributing to that. But if we really see in the moment that we're, what we're doing, why we do what we do, then we can maybe have more choice. Oh, maybe I don't have to do that. And one of the really important choices we have is to do nothing. And it can seem like almost nothing to do nothing. It can seem that doing nothing is kind of like, that's what it comes down to. Maybe that's just more kind of passivity, maybe it's more kind of denial, or it's kind of not being involved in the world. But certainly we should be involved, certainly we should act at times and do things. But the advantage of knowing how to do nothing is you can refrain from getting in trouble. And if you have a strong ability to pause and stop and not open your mouth at the wrong time and speak, not act in the wrong way, say you're angry, you could say something in anger and not even know that you're saying it at the time. You're just like caught up in the heat of the moment. And it never even occurred to you you have choice, because the heat of the moment is like, you know, you're not present enough to be able to be aware. And so you say something in a moment, and then you might have to spend the next years cleaning up from that, dealing with a broken relationship. And it might have been much more healthy for everyone involved if you had just kept your mouth shut. If you thought you had to think of the wisest thing you possibly could say and figure out the right thing, maybe it would have been too complicated. Maybe you were so filled with anger that it would have you weren't really capable of figuring out the right thing to say. And so maybe the best thing you could do in that circumstance is to keep your mouth shut, do nothing. And then maybe calm down, relax, get a good view of what's happening. And then when you're in a better place, then come back and respond. Then come back and try to deal with the situation. So that was an example. Sometimes learning the ability to do nothing, that's learning a choice. It's a choice to do nothing, to refrain. And that's a very powerful choice. And the reason I think it's so powerful is that some of the biggest mistakes we make in our life come from making mistakes. It comes from doing something. That if we had the wisdom to know, oh, this is not the time to act, we might not get in trouble. We might not do the mistakes that we might make. So the power of refrain is a choice to use that. So you don't have to be wise in terms of knowing what to do. You just know I don't know what to do right now, and it's safe enough not to do anything. So maybe I'll just be quiet. Does that make sense? Anyway, so those who see they have a choice, have a choice. And one of the choices we have is to do nothing. And that there are times when that's a very powerful choice. And to at least have that choice means that you have some kind of choice in almost all situations. And a choice might be something you use for 2 seconds. You know, it doesn't have to mean you're a long choice, just a pause to kind of catch your breath, get a better look, and then kind of figure out what to do with the situation that's wiser. So the emphasis on karma, as I like to present it today, is really to bring our attention into the present moment. And a lot of the teaching about karma is to show the importance of that. So the way it's come down to many people here in the West, some people think that karma is a teaching that of cosmic justice, that somehow everyone's going to get justice made sooner or later. And if you do something, you're going to get your dessert. You're going to get something's going to, you know. And it's kind of a very satisfying teaching for some people, because we don't want people who do evil things to get away with it. You know, to go do these terrible things, and then they get old. They get to be 98 years old, had a long life. And then they kind of go to sleep one day and quietly, you know, drift off and peacefully die. There's no justice in that. They got away with all the stuff they did, you know. That can't be. Well, let me tell you. the next lifetime, it's going to come back. And so sometimes the teaching of karma is used to try to be reassured that there is some kind of cosmic justice in the world, and everything kind of comes into harmony. Maybe there is. I'm not saying that it's not there, but I don't know. Certainly it's hard to prove that that's the case. And the need to have that kind of justified universe, I think comes out of insecurity, or comes out of something that's not really pointing to freedom. It's not so useful to be reassured that there's justice that kind of way. The other is that teaching of karma is a theory about that what you've done, it's all due to what you did in the past. And whatever you did in the past, whatever's happening to you today, is happening because you did something in the past. And if bad things are happening to you, then it must be because you did bad things in the past. The Buddha did not say that. He gave examples of all kinds of things that could happen to people that have nothing to do with their past actions. It could be because of the weather, or war, or, you know, disease, or all kinds of things can happen that don't have to be there because of your past actions. They're just part of life, and it comes along. Partly this Buddhist teachings of karma was formulated at a time in contrast to some of the other theories of causality in ancient India. One of the theories was that whatever happens to you happens because of the gods. And so you have to appease the gods, you have to sacrifice for the gods, and the gods have a big role. Another theory at the time of the Buddha was a theory that of predeterminism, that everything at the beginning of the cosmos, everything was predetermined, and so you just have to go along with the momentum of life. You can't really do anything about what's happening to you. You just have to live with it, and there's a certain momentum. Every person that's born gets reborn over and over again, and there's a certain momentum that has to play itself out, and when it all plays itself out, then you're free. But you can't do anything about it. Another theory was the idea that there is no determination for anything, that everything's random and chaotic, and so it doesn't really matter what you do. You can go out and kill and steal, and, you know, people might not like it, but there's no karmic consequence for doing that. So these are the Buddha offered an alternative theory, and it begins with this word karma, which means action. And it's a particular kind of action and a particular kind of effect from our action that I think the Buddha was pointing towards. So to try to give you an example of this, if you take a pond of water, a lake of water, the water is completely still and flat, and you throw a pebble into that water, then you get ripples on the water. And if you have a little kid's child boat floating on the water, that ripple comes by the water, a little wave, it'll shake the boat a little bit. If you throw a lot of stones into the lake, you get a whole bunch of waves that are bumping into each other, and they hit it off against each other, and it creates a kind of complicated network of circles and patterns of kind of waves, and so the boat is then rocking all kinds of ways in the water. That's physical kind of causality. What you did with your stone affects what happens. Now, if you see that boat, it's a kid's boat, and it's way out from the pond, and the kid is on the shore crying because he or she can't get the boat, then you might not just be throwing rocks into the pond just to see the boat rock. you might be throwing rocks because it's the only way you can think of to somehow get enough waves to push the boat to where the kids can get it. So somehow you're just kind of making little waves. That's the only thing, the only way you can think of doing it. So you're trying to help the kid. Or you could maybe think that kids are just a drag. And, you know, just, and you just want to, like, you know, kids are a nuisance. And, you know, you don't want having to do with this kid, and you don't even like kid toys. So you're going to throw a lot of rocks in that water and see if you can get the boat rocking and tipping enough that it could kind of get filled with water and sink. And the kid will, you know, not bother me anymore. So the physical causality is maybe the same. You know, the rocks go in the water and the waves make the water, makes the boat shake. But there's an internal psychological cause and effect, causality, depending on what has prompted me to throw the rocks in the pond. If I do it out of generosity and, or caring or compassion for the kid, that's going to set in motion a different set of conditions in my mind, in my heart, than if I do it out of spite for the kid. And you can probably imagine the difference. You know, one, if you're out of generosity, it just feels kind of, you feel happy, you succeed in helping the kid, it's out of compassion, out of warmth, out of care. And you leave, and somehow you've been conditioned, somehow you've been affected emotionally, psychologically, mentally, physically, by the care that you give the kid, that wherever you're going next, you might be in a very different state than if you got angry and spiteful and had this horrible idea about the kids and their, how nuisance they are. And you're kind of angry, bitter, you know, about, you know, life and kids. And it just kind of reinforces the anger and the bitterness that we have. So the inner psychological causality is the primary concern of the Buddhist teachings on karma. We don't know for sure what the physical causality of our acts are. They may or may not have an effect out there. They may or may not come back at us out in the world. But the psychological one, it's what's in our minds, that you can't get away from. So, for example, the person who's kind to the kid leaves the pond, goes out to the parking lot, and the cars are parked next to the little pond, and someone in the car there didn't see all this, and they get angry for you for the way you parked your car, so they bark at you. But you were the one who were so kind out there, and now this person's barking at you. That doesn't seem fair. The person who was spiteful and hated the kid and threw the rocks in, they got out into their car, and someone said, "Oh, that's a nice car you have. I hope you have a nice day." That doesn't seem fair either. If we're expecting this kind of cosmic justice thing. But it's more likely that if you left after doing this kind act, you're probably in a kind of kind disposition. And it's more likely that the people you run into the parking lot will feel that and see that. They might respond accordingly. And they might just be a little kinder to you because you seem like a nice, relaxed person. But if you were spiteful and hated this kid and hate kids and you were kind of stuck, you know, and you can kind of feel it, you can see, if someone can see in your face that you're, you know, you're grumpy and bitter, and they're more likely to treat you with fear or concern or kind of stay away from you, or they might affect you some way. But there's no guarantee which way it's going to go. So they say that, I like to think that what you do in the world, the world consequences, how it ripples out into the world and comes back at you, it tends to come back at you one way if you do things which are helpful in the world. And it tends to come back another way if you do things which are harmful for the world. But there's no guarantee there. That's not the place where the karmic equation in Buddhism is looking at. But rather it's psychological, in ourselves. What are the consequences for us? And I'd like to suggest that there are a number of different consequences, more psychological or internal. And the first I would like to talk about is what's called instant karma. And that is that the effect of how you act can be felt, and what motivates you in your action can be felt in your body and mind. So if you're just out by yourself for a nice little walk and you just kind of think it's fun to throw pebbles into the pond and see the ripples, it probably doesn't, just nice. It's maybe relaxing a little bit, it's nice. But if you're throwing those rocks in order to get the boat back to the shore and helping the kid, you can feel, maybe you feel a warmth, a caring for the kid, you feel like you're helping, you feel like you're connected in a nice way, it seems like a simple enough thing to do to help, and it kind of has a warm, satisfying, rewarding feeling in the heart, in the mind, in the muscles, that's nice. The idea of compassionate care is supposed to, when it's really done purely, it's supposed to create a nice feeling for us. You do this, throw stones out of spite for the kid in order to, sink the boat. The anger, the bitterness that goes into that kind of view, if you feel it, it feels tense, feels contracted, it feels closed. All kinds of ways that it actually feels physically and psychologically. It doesn't feel good. So the instant karma has to do with the psychophysical way that it feels like to act on some motivations versus other motivations. And we can feel that difference in ourselves. And so the karma, the consequences are instant in the very nature of the motivation of why we're doing something. The emotionality that's going feeding into it. And one of the things we can pay attention to, and one of the guides that Buddhism offers for our behavior, is what does it feel like for you in the present moment to do it, to be that way? And the chances are, if you feel worse in doing the action, maybe it's not a wise thing to do. Maybe you haven't found the best motivation to come from. Be careful. There's instant karma. But to see the instant karma consequences, you have to be present. So if you're in a heated argument and you're angry with someone, you're not paying attention to yourself. You're not mindful of the... But if you're really mindful, you'll see, oh, this hurts. And I've known people who gave up anger that they carried with them for years, resentment. When they realized that the person they were resentful for was not being affected at all by their resentment. I've been going around for years, resenting and fuming, and that no good lousy person's living a happy life doesn't even know that I'm resentful for all these years. Who's hurting here? And after many years of feeling this way, okay, I give up. I stopped. There's no purpose to it. I've known people who really saw the effect that anger had on themselves and said, the cost of being angry is not worth it. Even though I feel justified and I kind of feel like I'm right and it's so good to feel right, actually so painful to feel that. So if we really can feel the cost of what's driving us, what the motivations are, what the emotions are, some of us, we might switch what we're doing because the cost is too high. The instant karmic consequences are not good. Or the opposite can happen. We feel, wow, that was a good consequence. Wow, that was really nice. I feel so much more settled, I'm sleeping better. I kind of don't feel in conflict with myself when I was honest. I should try being honest more often. Maybe that's a good idea. So there's instant karma, the effect it has right now. And that has a very important role, because you can start, then you start noticing the quality, the ethical quality of the motivations of why you're doing what you're doing. Because it's the ethical quality of the motivations that affect the longer-term consequences of karma. So motivations that have to do with causing harm in the world, they affect us psychophysically in a different way than the motivations that are to cause benefit for the world, and all the different ways that that can play itself out. So the longer-term consequences of our actions, has to do with our musculature, our muscles. Some ways, some motivations, some ways of engaging in the world, we feel more tense. So if you're angry, anger tends to be a more tense physical experience than being compassionate. Compassionate tends to be relaxing in and of itself. And if a person is chronically angry, the tension can build, and so it doesn't kind of relax quickly, but it kind of gets built into the musculature, the muscles of our body, and it might stay chronically tense for years. And the cause of that chronic tension has its roots in the anger that a person is carrying around. So that anger, that tension, is the ongoing karmic consequence of being angry. There's also the karmic consequence, the consequence we have to live with, of the memories of what happened. And the memory of helping the kid get his boat, it was a simple thing, it was nice to do, but actually, you sit in your old age and you happen to go for a little walk along a pond and I did this once. I was at a pond. That was a nice thing. I remember seeing that little kid was so happy and smiling, and she thanked me so nicely. Oh, yeah, that was a nice memory. And you kind of feel kind of relaxed and peaceful, and maybe sitting there peacefully on your bench, and maybe you're 98 years old, and you remember this nice little story, this nice, beautiful, angelic smile of the kid said thank you, and oh, thank you. What a nice way. This kid who said, thank you. I'm grateful for this life. It just happens to be your last breath because you're 98. That's pretty cool. You're going to die that way, right? Wow. Or you're 98 years old. bitter. And somehow you make it to a pond, and all these ponds, they're so dirty, and no one takes care of them properly, and these benches kind of, they don't make better, softer benches, and I'm going to write a letter to the city council. And that kid. And you start getting angry again and filled, and then you realize, I think my time is coming. Oh, but that kid. So you don't know when your memories are going to come back. And they might come back at the wrong time. Or they might, they're stored up in there. And that's maybe a silly story, I told you. But for people who are meditators, it seems that there are a number of memories that are kind of like unresolved in our lives. They kind of get stuck in there. And they'll come up to be processed sooner or later. And my teacher in Burma, my meditation teacher in Burma, he was very fond of telling stories of people who had been either Burmese soldiers fighting the guerrillas, or the guerrillas fighting the Burmese soldiers. They would come to they'd come and meditate in the monastery after they retired, and they'd done horrible things. And he would tell stories that they'd sit and meditate, and after a few weeks on retreat, the memories would come back. And he would give a graphic discussion about how difficult it was for them to sit with those memories, and that it was necessary for them to go through it and deal with it and purge it and something, and how difficult it was. Their stories were always good. I mean, they always succeeded, but it was not easy. So the memories that we carry with us are not incidental. that sometimes, you know, they come back and they have a huge impact on us if we, you know, we're storing and holding these negative kind of things. And my impression is that when we do cause harm in the world, it gets stored in our muscles and our memories and our psyche in a much more unresolved, tense, repressed place than if we do good in the world, helpful things in the world. It doesn't have the same, the good doesn't have the same kind of powerful, kind of explosive or powerful sense of kind of being closed off. And so when the good, remember the good, it tends to nourish us as opposed to something we have to kind of struggle with and purge. And so the memories we have to deal with. The other thing that happens ongoing with the actions we live by them, what motivates us, is it creates psychological conditioning. So we create habits. We create the conditions in the mind for us to behave a certain way in the future. So if I'm angry a lot, anger takes a lot of energy. So I get tired. I'm tired and angry. And then I go along into the world and a small little thing happens. And I'm just kind of this habit of being angry. And I'm so tired I can't think of doing anything else. So I just snap at everyone I see. There's a kind of conditioning that's in place. A habit, the tendency to be angry becomes more of a habit that we do more automatically. And it was, you know, when the conditions of the mind are not very good, we feel uncomfortable, and feeling uncomfortable makes us irritated, and so it kind of becomes a self-reinforcing pattern. The conditioning of kindness and compassion has a very different effect on the mind. We're creating a habit. And so if we act on compassion and kindness, we're more likely to do that in the future. We're more likely to occur to us to do it in the future. It becomes a little bit more of a habit. The effect of compassion and kindness is not as exhausting, not as much of a strain on the mind. It maybe kind of makes us more open, feel good about our lives. And so we go into the next activity we do during the day, and so we're in a little bit better shape. We're conditioned so we're more balanced, and so we're more likely to, you know, not be angry, more likely to do something kind again, which is self-reinforcing. So these are kind of rational ways of talking, that the karmic actions we do, the cycle that come out of our motivations, comes out of our intentions, they can affect our bodies, they can affect our memories, they can affect the conditioning that goes into our minds. All the different ways. And that's kind of, you know, a nice rational kind of way of explaining it. But the mind is so complex, and there's so much in the subconscious mind where we store there, and the conditioning is kind of invisible to us, that we don't always see it so directly. And so there is in the kind of discussion about karma, a kind of a little bit mysterious quality of it, or kind of a little sense that, you know, or say it differently, there is an idea that it's really good to have faith and trust that in this laws of karma, meaning that that psychologically in the internal life that you live, how you act, what you do, is something you're going to experience the consequence of in the future. That what you do now has consequences. And so you want to be very careful what you do now, so you want to set up consequences for you that are beneficial in the future. And this is one of the reasons why the teaching of karma emphasizes the importance of paying attention to the present moment. So you have a choice in the present moment, and it's a wise thing to do to make good choices. Because the choices you make here are going to affect your future well-being. And how do you pay attention to what you do here? One of the things you do is you slow down, you stop for a few moments, pause, to really notice what's happening here. You can notice what's happening in your body. The body is a great indicator of what's happening more deeply. If you're tense, if you feel tight in your body, you know, is this a time to look more deeply and see what's really happening for you emotionally? Because maybe this is a time to be extra careful. Maybe when you're tense, you should be more quick to say nothing, to refrain, be more careful. So what's going on? So look at your body as a kind of shorthand. What's happening here? And then what's the motivation? Or what's the intention? What's the emotional fuel for what you're doing? The motivation to throw rocks, you know, someone sees you throwing rocks in the pond, say, what's motivating you? What you're doing? Oh, I'm just motivated to throw rocks in the pond to make waves. That's fine if there's no kid there with a boat. But what's motivating you is, I'm trying to help the kid. What's motivating is, I really, you know, want to get, you know, harm kids. Kids should be harmed. Very different motivation. One is out of anger, one's out of compassion. So to notice, what is the motivation? What is the ethical quality of the motivation? Ethical quality means, is it something that is affecting harm in the world, or something that wants to benefit the world? And if it's causing harm in any kind of way, intends harm, or is going to cause harm, then be very careful. Not only because you don't want to cause harm, but because if you want to take care of your own well-being into the future, you want to be careful about creating the right conditions, the right conditioning, the right body to live in, the right habits of mind that you have, so that you're more likely to be kind and compassionate, more likely to be relaxed, more likely to not live with remorse, more likely to not have to deal with the repercussions of your negative actions. They make a big difference. So the teachings of Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on this karmic teachings. It makes more and more sense, this emphasis, the more you do something like meditation. Because the more you do meditation, the more you see, or the more you're practicing mindfulness, the more you see the subtlety in which this works. And the subtle little things make a difference. And the little things build up over time. So a little lie might seem fine when you're busy and running around and no one seems to notice. But if you are getting quieter and quieter, more and more attentive, you can notice, even that little lie, that white lie, has a negative effect on me. And maybe it has longer term consequences. They say that if you make a lie, your life is more complicated because you have to remember the lie to be able to keep it going. But if you don't lie, then you have less to have to remember. It's easier to get through life. So the point being, as people kind of do more and more of this practice, it becomes more and more natural, more reasonable, more interesting, more valuable to start becoming more and more careful with what's going on, what kind of karmic momentum you're setting in motion. So there's no need to blame yourself for what you did in the past. No need to weigh yourself down. No need to be angry towards yourself. Because if you do that, you're creating bad karma for yourself. The past is the past. You can learn from it, learn from our mistakes, learn from what we did. But there's no need to add negative conditioning on top of that. And one form of negative conditioning is to be critical of oneself. And I'm a bad person, I'm a terrible, guilt and all that. But rather, use the past to learn how to be better in the present by paying careful attention to what you're actually doing in the moment, so you can make wiser choices. And if you make wiser choices, chances are the world will respond better to you, but there's no guarantee. But your own heart and mind will become your friend. Your own inner life will be there to support you in beautiful ways, and to then be nourished by the goodness of your heart, be nourished by what goes on inside, is one of the great blessings of a lifetime. And so how do you create the right, how do you create the conditions so your inner life becomes your best friend? It's a process. And it's a process of being careful to be in the present moment and being careful, lovingly careful, kind with yourself, and to make the choices that creates good karmic consequences. You don't want to sit on the edge of the pond of your heart and be that grumpy old guy with wants to drown the boat, looking into your heart. Hopefully you can sit on the edge of the pond of your heart and say, there, there, I'll help you. I'll get your boat out. And then everyone will be happy. May you take your boat to the other shore. Thank you.